My name's Cameron. I'm a member of Cocaine Anonymous. I hope my Canadian accent isn't too thick to understand what I'm saying. I know when I spoke in Glasgow, you know, they were speaking. I don't know what they were saying, but it wasn't English I could figure out. But anyhow, it's great to be here. Hey, if you haven't already, you know, given a donation to this group and the good works it's doing, please do so. That's one way you can carry the message, support the groups that support you to getting the message of recovery. I always like to say when I'm in an in-person meeting and we pass the hat around, I go, starve a dealer, give generously to the seven. So one of the things I like to do when I'm in the rooms, I'm always asking the question because there's a lot of misconceptions, a lot of misunderstandings of what a 12-step program is all about. And so I'm always asking people, are you working a program? You know, and the most common response I get is, oh, yeah, I go to meetings. I go to meetings every day, sometimes three meetings a day. Meeting makers make it, you know, 90 and 90. And I go, no, that's not what I'm talking about. Are you working with someone? And they go, oh, yeah, I got a sponsor. I call my sponsor every day. I don't make a decision till I talk to my sponsor. My sponsor tells me who I can sleep with and how to manage my money. And they consult me on my relationships. And I just don't make a decision till I talk to my sponsor. You know, a lot of sponsors are insane, right? Do you really want an insane person managing your life? I had this one woman call me up. She was so pissed at her sponsor. I said, well, what's going on? She said, well, my sponsor told me in order to recover, I had to clean his house twice a week. Now, Dr. Bob did say clean house, but I don't think he meant it quite so literally, right? A lot of crazy ass shit comes out of sponsors' mouths. You know, I met one person. She went to the largest meeting in Toronto, 350 people in this room. And she had to show up in her pajamas to show willingness. Like, who comes up with this shit, right? But, you know, this is the kind of stuff I hear. And I go, no, that's not what I'm talking about. Are you working with a newcomer? And they look at me like I got three bloody heads on. And they go, newcomer, I'm still a newcomer. I've only been in the program 2 years. This is a selfish program. I got to work on me first. And you know what? I never see them again. Now, the untreated addict has this uncanny ability to dig holes. You know, we don't build things, we dig. We dig holes as untreated addicts, and we dig deep holes. And being the nature of us, we ultimately fall into the hole and we're stuck. And we cry out for help. And the first people to come along to try to help us down in the hole are family members, friends, the employer. You know, they bail us out of trouble. They offer those frothy emotional appeals, and they're forever extending that proverbial ladder into the hole, saying, please climb out. We love you. Please climb out. But what does the addict do? He trades his ladder in for a 20-piece of crack and digs his hole a little deeper and cries out for help. Then the religious community comes along and says, here, we have a solution for you there down in the hole. Read this scripture. Let me kneel and pray with you for a while. But because it's a program of faith without works, it avails the addict very little power and they remain stuck. Then the medical community comes along. They're very motivated to find answers for us untreated addicts. They come up with all sorts of medical interventions like Antabuse, Suboxone, Methadone, Clarazepam, Diazepam, Perazepam. I remember my doctor saying to me, he says, Cameron, you're depressed. I said, you think? I burned my life to the ground. Nobody wants to be around me. I got nothing. Yeah, I'm depressed, but I'm trying to get off pills. I don't need more pills in my life. And the trouble with the pill solution is the prescriptions expire, the pills run out, and the awful pain of being an untreated addict comes to bear down on me. And then the multi-billion dollar treatment center comes along with their 1% success rates. And they go, here, we have a solution for you addicts down in the hole. It's called group. You ever been to group? Right? You sit in a circle, a problem shared is a problem have, right? And here's the problem. They bring this crap into our rooms. You might have been to one of these meetings. I call them open, disgusting meetings where you go in a room, and Hollywood makes fun of us all the time. You know, whenever they portray a 12-step meeting, it's always a group of people in a circle with very despondent looks on their faces. They don't want to be there. Some of them are court mandated, and it's problem, like an incessant Oprah wine fest, group therapy without a therapist. And by the end of the meeting, there's no hope, there's no faith, there's no courage, and I'm a psychological casualty of that group. And now I need a meeting to fix the meeting that I was supposed to get that at. You ever been to one of those meetings? I'd rather masturbate with a handful of broken glass than to go to a meeting like that. They're awful. And yet I see them. You know, our book is very clear. Talk about clear-cut instruction. We must be careful not to drift into worry, remorse, or morbid reflection. But where do I see that? I see it in the rooms. And of course, you know, the counselor after, you know, they always love to ask this question. I love this at treatment. How do you feel? And I look at them. I go, how do I feel? As an untreated addict, I have two feelings. I feel like using and I feel like murdering you. Those are the only two feelings I've got as an untreated addict. How do I feel? Oh, my God. And then after about an hour of sharing, the counselor goes, you're all beautiful people, but I practice a professional class of therapy and I got to go pick up my paycheck. And the addict realizes, hey, I'm still in the hole. Now, I got good news and bad news. The good news is there is a way out of the hole. The bad news is many of you are too selfish, too self-seeking, too frightened, and too fearful to do the work, and you're going to die, and it's going to be an awful death. I've been working with others for 20 years, and out of that mix, I buried 44 to date, and I bury most people to alcohol death. Alcohol is still the number one killer. Kill you when you drink it, kill you when you detox from it. Fentanyl's number two. Another drug that's really bad out there in its prescription are the benzos, right? Benzodiazepine, clorazepam, diazepam, perazepam. They figure a third of North Americans are on a benzo of some sort. It's awful what's going out there. So our stories are supposed to disclose in a general way what we're like, what happened, what we're like today. And, you know, I introduced myself as a member of Cocaine Anonymous because there's a big difference between being a member of this amazing fellowship and being an untreated addict. Now, I'm not going to belabor the war story. You know, we're all experts in the problem, right? Is there any novices here? Anybody here not know how to use or drink? Anybody need, you know, more instruction on that? You know, like we're all experts on it, right? What we don't hear a lot of or enough of in the rooms is the way out, the solution, the clear-cut instructions. I always know I'm in for one of those wild drunkalogues when the speaker starts off with, I remember my first drink. I was in my mother's third trimester, and I realized I didn't drink like other fetuses. And I go, oh, God, here we go, right? And the next 40 minutes is it's just, you know, destruction and mayhem. And oh, my God, war story after war story. So I'm not going to belabor that. So what am I like as an untreated alcoholic addict? I love drinking bourbon. I like smoking dope and I like smashing cocaine. It brings out a very impotent, lazy asshole persona. You know, cocaine, smashing cocaine is an awful drug. It would ramp me up like a sexual tyrannosaurus and give me a dick the size of a button. Like it was really horrible stuff. And yet, you know, well, despite all the debilitating effects I get, I would still keep going back to it. I love drinking and using more than my every job I was fired from. I became an entrepreneur thinking I couldn't get fired that way. I was in for a rude awakening. I love it more than my children. I was a needle user. I was irresponsible as a father. I'd be out sharing dirty needles with people, and I'd leave my dirty tools laying around the house. I remember waking up, seeing my four-year-old son playing squirt guns with one of my dirty needles. I felt awful as a father, but it did not have the power to keep me sober. My wife would beg, plead, offer those frothy emotional appeals, threaten me with divorce. But I love the effect of alcohol and drugs more than my own marriage. I love the effect of drugs and alcohol so much that I'm willing to risk my life. Y'all think of what you were willing to risk when you were out there as an untreated addict. My doctor in 2000 said, Cameron, you got liver disease. Your liver's descended, your enzymes are through the roof, you keep drinking, you're going to die. As soon as I heard that news, the first thought that went through my head was, I need a drink right now. That's awful news, right? Now, normal people, I call them muggles. My wife's a muggle. That's a Harry Potter term for non-wizard. My wife has the solution. She goes, Cameron, just don't drink, just don't drug. Oddly enough, that is the solution. But I can't seem to apply it. Why? You know, it's so crazy. I know I'm destroying my life. I know I'm going to get sicker and sicker if I continue, yet I keep returning to it. Why? Because I got this liar in my head. Now, the big book talks about that mental blank spot, that strange phenomenon that parallels our sound reasoning and fails to hold us in check. I call it the liar. And the liar loves to drink. The liar loves to use drugs. And it doesn't want to give it up under no circumstance. So it built this research institute in my brain. It's called Bullshit Inc. And they research new ideas, new excuses, new reasons, and new justifications. Even though my life is in the toilet, I burned it to the ground. This time when I drink or use, somehow, some way, I'm going to be able to control and enjoy it. And here's the problem. No matter how much I want to stop, the liar always wins the argument. Y'all relate to that liar that lives in our head? I'm like a dog that returns to its own vomit. You ever seen a dog eat something, makes it foully sick, throws it up? What does the dog do? It eats its vomit, only to throw it up again. That's what I'm like as an untreated addict. I'm like a dog that continuously returns to my vomit. Now, untreated, I'm restless, I'm irritable, I'm discontented, I'm bored, I'm depressed, I'm anxious, and I don't like feeling that way. So my solution is to drink and use. Drinking and using is not my problem. It's my solution. Running out is a problem. And in the beginning, it seemed like the answer. Remember when we first started drinking or using and that wonderful effect came over our bodies and we went, yeah, this is the way I want to feel. And it seemed like the answer. In the beginning, it was all fun. Midway, it was fun with problems. And in the end, it was nothing but problems. Because it's a progressive illness if you've got the illness of addiction or the illness of alcoholism. And, you know, it got to the point where I'd like to tell you, I'm just going to go to the pub, have a pint, maybe a couple shots of bourbon, and come home. But I can't really predict that outcome. That's what I believe I'm going to do. But once I start drinking or using, I lose all control. I have no idea how long it's going to last. It could last a night. Could go on for a day, a week, a month, a year. I have no idea. And then at some point, I emerge from this horror show and I have a moment of clarity and I come up for air and I go, oh my God, I can't go on like this. And I'm filled with horror and remorse and hopelessness. And I make a firm resolution. I'm not going to do it again. We've all done that, right? Made that firm resolution, that solemn oath, that promise. You know, I'm convinced that they hooked us up to lie detector tests. It would register as truthful for all of us. But here's the problem. I know I can't live with it anymore, but I don't know how to live without it. So I'm told to go to meetings. And I end up in one of those open, disgusting rooms, right? And I sit there. There's no solution. And I enter into what I call sobriety, where there's no solution. I just dry out. And I start getting restless and irritable and discontented and bored and depressed. And then the liar comes out of remission and says, hey, we need our solution. And the liar always wins the argument. And I succumb to my desire again. And out I go. And I repeat this behavior over and over and over. Spree, remorse, resolution. Spree, remorse, resolution. Pursuing my love of alcohol and drugs to the gates of insanity or death. Raise your hand if you know someone who's died from addiction, right? If you got it, it's a death sentence. Here's the other thing I've noticed in the rooms. Out of over 20 years of working with others, out of the 44 people that I've worked with directly who are dead, 9 hung themselves in sobriety. Now, why would someone hang themselves in sobriety? Because they were in sobriety. They were nuts. They knew they couldn't live with it. They didn't know how to live without it. And they went insane. The suicide rates in 12 steps today is 80 times higher than normal society. An untreated addict is 80 times more likely to take their own life in the first 5 years of sobriety. And it's a real problem in the room. Some of you may have known some people who have committed suicide, either through intentional overdose or actually, you know, hung themselves or whatever. And it's so unnecessary. And that statistic comes out of the Oxford Handbook to Psychiatry. This is the horror of step one. It's the realization nothing secular, nothing human is going to stop me from drinking or using. I will drink. I will use again. And for me to drink and use again is to die. And that's a horrifying conclusion. Yet as a member of Cocaine Anonymous, it's been 20 years since I've had any desire to drink or use. I'm an alcoholic addict who doesn't drink or use. That's a paradoxical thing for any one of us to admit as self-admitted alcoholic addicts. How is that possible? And I came into these rooms and I was fortunate enough to meet someone who was armed with the facts about themselves. They knew what it was like to live in that hole. Two, they had a solution. They had a way out. And three, they had a generosity of spirit. And they showed me a way out of that inescapable hole. And as a result of learning this amazing program called the 12 Steps to Cocaine Anonymous, I was able to rebuild my marriage. I was a violent alcoholic drug addict. And through the program, I was able to rebuild a destroyed marriage. My wife and I are celebrating 33 years of marriage this year. I have the love and trust of my children. My daughter is 36. My son is 38. My daughter comes to visit every week. I have a lovely relationship with my daughter. Something that I was estranged from her for many years. My son is 38. And thank God he's not an addict like me, but he has an autistic, nonverbal 12-year-old boy. So for me to be sober and to be there to support him in those challenges, man, that's a gift. It's a gift CA gives me. My liver went back to normal after 6 years, another miracle of this program. There's a line in the big book that says, go out and see what other religious people are doing. So I thought, I'll go get a degree. So I enrolled in the University of Toronto, the 18th ranked Ivy League university in the world. And I did a degree in medical anthropology and religion. By the way, here are three really good predictors of recovery. One, we work with others. Two, we go back to school. We improve ourselves, you know, for our families, our careers, our communities. You know, the third thing I see addicts do that tell me they got a great program, they fix their teeth. Who's got money for teeth when we're out there, right? So if you're fixing your teeth, going back to school and working with others, man, you are golden. This program has taken me around the world prior to COVID. You know, I've been to Sweden, Spain, across England, United States, Canada. Man, the fellowship has been so generous to me over the years. And then when COVID hit and this amazing platform called Zoom came about, man, we pulled the whole fellowship together in a global village. You know, I meet the same salt of the earth all over the world coming into rooms like this. What an amazing, amazing platform we have before us where we can bring us all together across the planet in one common solution of recovery. And to me, that's what it means to be a member of Cocaine Anonymous. I am a member of Cocaine Anonymous. I'm an alcoholic addict who doesn't drink or use anymore. So, how did I get from a 26-year losing streak where I was drinking morning, noon, and night from the age of 20 to the age of 46 to enjoying 20 years of sobriety where I can easily control my desire to drink or use? So as I said, I met this person who was armed with the facts, had a solution, and a generosity of spirit. We didn't go to a meeting. He took me out of the room. He said, Cameron, I'm watching you die. Let me show you how to work a program. We went to a coffee shop, opened up big books, and started working steps. The first thing he said to me, he says, Cameron, you're going to be a sponsor. The whole foundation stone of your recovery is you being a sponsor. Do you know what mentions in the big book in the first 88 pages before we get into the chapter working with others? It mentions 124 times in the first 88 pages, work with another alcoholic. And they don't mean your sponsor. They mean work with the guy or the gal that's in the hole and show them a way out. Bill and Bob understood the power of one alcoholic working with another alcoholic. When I sponsor, I co-sponsor. We do the journey together, arm in arm. I do my steps, you do your steps, and we share the magic. The magic is in the sharing. And together we go touch the face of God. And that's a hell of an experience. Right? I'm looking for the same power you're all looking for right now. I look for it daily. And I'm given a program that shows me how to access that power to let me easily control my desire to drink or to use. You know, when I was doing the university studies, I was writing a paper about 12 steps. And medical anthropology is the study of humans and their healing systems. And of course, 12 steps is an alternative healing system. And I found this Baltimore, Maryland drug study. It's an amazing study. It was done in the year 2000, and they had 500 injection drug users. And they had three groups. These were heroin and cocaine injection users. And they had three groups: with sponsors, those without sponsors, and those that sponsored others. And at the end of 1 year, they looked at the sobriety rate. Now, those with sponsors and those without sponsors, there was no difference in their sobriety rate, which was about 40%. Now, that signified two things. You're just as likely to sober up with or without a sponsor. And two, having a sponsor is no predication of power. One of the first things I tell the newcomer is, I'm not the power. I'm going to fail you. I'm certainly going to say something to piss you off, or I'm not going to be there when you need me the most. But those that sponsored others, 75% of the room was still sober at the end of the first year. And we know that from the forward to the second edition. 50% sober up once, 25% sober up after a few relapses. That 75% success rate is very consistent for those who really try and work the program. So I'm what's called a big book sponsor. I use the big book. I love the big book. It's written like an instruction manual. It's written like a recipe. And if you follow the instructions exactly as they're laid out, the end result is an awakening of a power deep down within ourselves, an intuitive knowing that solves the most baffling problems. And I access a power that lets me easily control that desire to drink or use. The biggest controversy I get into the rooms, you would think it would be with counselors or status quo members or you know, the meeting makers. I get along with them fine. It's usually the other big book thumpers. They get really nutty about the program, and they've all got their way of doing it. Their way's the best way. And, you know, I always think if the only tool in your kit is a hammer, everything starts looking like a nail, and not everyone needs to be treated like a nail. I have several different ways that I approach the big book solution with people. I use the big book. That's my basic recovery text, but I have different ways of approaching it. And I have no monopoly on the solution, but I found some pretty good ways of going through it. And if you know your history, they all worked it quickly. The question is, how fast should we take the newcomer through the steps? Some people say take a year. I don't think we got a year. Some people say 90 days. Even 90 days is dicey. Now, the beginner meetings of the 1940s, they did it in 4 one-hour sessions over the course of a month. But I find even a month is dicey. So when I take someone through the 12 steps, I do it in roughly 10 to 14 days. Lack of power. That's our dilemma. Looking at your situation, if lack of power is your dilemma, what's the likelihood you're going to pick up and use again? Well, it's pretty much 100%. Well, let's go find the power now. That's why I smash cocaine. I want my ringer now. So when it comes to the God dope, the spiritual dope, I want it now. I'm an addict. And the good news is you can have it now if you're willing to do the work. That's usually how I bait my audiences. I tell them, you know, you can have it right now if you're willing to do the work. You know, God can work miracles in a second if you really access it. So I work it quickly. You know, Ebbie Thatcher was 60 days sober when he carried the message to Bill Wilson. Bill Wilson was 7 days sober out of Towns Hospital on his third treatment and started frantically looking for other alcoholics to work with. Dr. Bob was 2 weeks sober when he carried the message to Bill Dotson, AA number 3. They all worked it quickly. You know, we're dealing with life and death situations here. So we started this journey and we came to that second step, came to believe in a power greater than ourselves would restore us to sanity, came to believe in a power. You know, the first tool, this first spiritual tool we lay at the feet of the newcomer is this concept of a power greater than ourselves. You know, and you think, what? You mean you tell me treatment, sponsors, meetings, incomprehensible, demoralizing experiences, my children, my spouse, these things aren't going to keep me sober, but a concept of a power greater than myself will? And I go, yeah, absolutely. And that's a real flimsy read, isn't it? And that's the flimsy read they talk about. But it turns out to be that powerful hand of God. You know, and we're not talking about a make-believe power, because when I've got a needle in this arm and a needle in this arm and I'm getting the best blow job of my life, that's got a lot of power to it. So this thing you call God, it better be fucking real, or I'll go back to what I know is real. And I'm here to bear witness that it is a real power. Now, there's three things that take place in step two in order to get this step. One is let the testimony of others bear witness to this power. Y'all think of someone in these rooms who's gone down the rabbit hole as far as you have, if not further, but they claim a power greater than themselves that restored them to sanity. That's bearing witness to this power at work. The second thing, the ability to think honestly. And the third thing, to search diligently within ourselves. That's where the power is, deep down within ourselves. That's another paradox. Where do I find a power that's greater than me, greater than the cocaine, greater than the alcohol, greater than the fentanyl? You're going to find this power deep down within yourself. That's paradoxical, but that's the reality. And I see it bear witness with people in the rooms. And I know there's people in this room here today that bear witness to this power at work of God doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. And we start that amazing journey of step two. Now, step three, I realize there's power out there. I see it working in others. Hey, you're like me. I'm like you, but you don't do it anymore. How is that possible? Well, I got this power. Well, then in step three, we make a decision to go after this power. I make a decision to turn my will and my life over to God as I understand it. What do I mean by that? What do? By our will, we mean we turn our thinking over. Why should I turn my thinking over to God? Who's running my brain untreated? The liar. That's why slogans like remember when, think, play the tape all the way through don't work for us, because the liar's running the show. When do we always remember when? After the fact, right? So I got to fire the liar and I'm hiring God. And here's the thing. Step three is I'm going to make God the principal. I'm going to be its agent. We're no longer in our business. We're in the God business now. We're agents of God. Wouldn't that be a cool business card to hand out at a meeting? Hi, my name's Cameron, agent of God. How can I be helpful? That's the business we're in. We're all agents of God now. What a great job description. And instead of spending my day as a dishonest, resentful, selfish, fearful man in everything that I touch, instead I go God's way. I'm going to be honest. I'm going to be pure. I'm going to be unselfish, and I'm going to be loving, and I'm going to apply those spiritual principles to all my affairs. And in doing so, I access that power. A lot of people think 12 steps is about quitting, but if you understand step one, we can't quit. We will drink. We will use again. But by applying God's will daily, we get a daily reprieve where we access a power that lets us easily control our desire to drink or use for that day. That's the secret of our program. Now, the first time I tried to meditate and connect to God with that wonderful step three prayer, I start my day with the step three prayer meditation. It's my daily baptism. It's my affirmation that I'm going to be a member of a 12-step program and an agent of God. The first time I tried to meditate, connect to that power deep down within, I was so full of resentments and fears and harms and yap-yap voices just driving me crazy, and I couldn't connect. So step four and five is an inventory process of getting right with myself, where I'm going to tease out through my resentments and my fears and my harms, my moral conduct, my moral defects, my shortcomings. And I learned something really awful about myself. I am an arrogant, bigoted, misogynistic, impatient, slanderous, hateful, misanthropic. I'm looking at all these awful character defects, and my sponsor looks at this list, and it's the same defects coming up after resentment, fear and harm and all those things. And he says, you see that list, Cameron? That's your resume as an untreated addict. Next time you go for a job interview or post your eHarmony profile, that's what you should be posting, because that's who they're getting. And I found that really objectionable. But what's really great about understanding our defects, it reveals where the power is. There's no power in hatred, but there's power in acceptance and forgiveness and love. There's no power in being self-seeking, but there's power in being helpful to others. And now I got a track to run on. I understand what the bondage of Cameron is. More importantly, I understand my job description under God's will. And here's another paradox. God hires people with the worst resumes to do his work. That's so paradoxical. I love step four and five, getting right with myself. Now, six and seven is where we get right with God. Now, if all we need to know are our defects and God's will for us, then we'd only have five steps. But behavioral modification dialectical behavioral therapy. Behavioral modification doesn't work for me, so I need a divine intervention. And in step six, I see the futility, the fatality, and the destructiveness of my character defects and how it destroys everything I touch. And in step seven, I get right with God and I ask God for the strength and the willingness to let this man go and the courage, have the faith and courage to be the man I meant to be in step seven. And then in steps eight and nine, I get right with others. I take these spiritual principles and I apply them to all those destroyed relationships and I start making reparations. Look at the power we're building in this program. Step one, we have no power. We die on step one. Step two, we realize there's power out there. We see it working in others. Step three, we make a decision to go look for the power. Step four and five, we figure out what blocks us from the power, what gives us access to the power. And by eight and nine, we're getting right with others and we're wielding a power in our life that we're cleaning up the destruction of our past. And we are rocketed into the fourth dimension of existence. We enter the spirit world in that vehicle of steps one to nine. And then in 10 and 11, we're given a design for living that really works, a way to live our daily lives without booze or drugs in it. And we're giving these principles and instructions on how to live without it. And then having had this spiritual awakening in step 12, we try to carry the message to the addict that still suffers, practice these principles in all our affairs. A balanced program for me is I take care of family first, take care of what God has given me. Secondly, work. I need to be self-supporting. If I'm not, I can't take care of family. And then in my spare time, part-time, I carry the message to the addict that still suffers. Nothing ensures immunity as intensive work as working with other addicts who are suffering and showing them a way out. And when you sit down with someone who's so far gone and they're so deep in the hole, you don't think they'll ever climb out. And to watch them climb out, to watch them recover, and then to bear witness to them paying it forward, because we get to keep it by giving it away. We pay it forward. To bear witness to them paying it forward to another suffering addict, man, you don't want to miss out on that experience. That's the best dope there is, the spiritual dope. It's a ringer every time I connect to it, right? Look at the power of step 12. We heal the seemingly hopeless. Everybody's failed the addict, friends and family, the religious community, the medical community, the treatment center community. Yet we as lay addicts, armed with the facts about ourselves, our common solution, and a generosity of spirit, God wields a power through us where we heal the seemingly hopeless. So the next time you hear the addict shouting out for help from the hole, what should we do? We jump into the hole with them. And they're so bewildered. They look at us and they go, now we're both in the hole. But we can turn to our brothers and sisters with a wink in our eye and we can say, hey, it's okay. I've been here before. I got a way out. I got a way out with more hope, faith, and courage. I got a way out to walk hand in hand with the sunlight of the spirit. I got a way out to being an intelligent agent, a spearhead of God's ever-advancing creation. And I'm for that. How about you? God bless. See you on the firing lines of recovery, everyone.